Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week, people from around the world will be watching and reading about what is perhaps the best-known bike race in the world, the Tour de France, made even more popular as of late by the greatest bicyclist in history, Lance Armstrong. Fred Nielsen marks the annual event by interviewing David Herlihy, the author of a new book on the history of the bicycle. Following Fred Nielsen's conversation with David Herlihy, we will hear from Sam Weinberg, who will answer the question, shouldn't teachers of history have majored in history? And Kelly Shrum tells us about a website where many people can learn about living in history, or to be more specific, where they can listen and read about Amy Wire's experiences of living as a New England colonist as part of the PBS series Colonial House. But first, let's take a look at a couple of articles on history in the news you may have missed. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which collectively have been labeled a classic of anti-Semitism, turn 100 this year. They are among the most successful pieces of conspiracy propaganda ever written. That success is puzzling, writes Peter Edidin for the New York Times. First, it's a preposterous work purporting to reveal a conspiracy hatched at the World Zionist Congress in 1897, calling for Jews to join with Freemasons in destroying Christianity and ruling a global state. Second, he continued, the protocols have repeatedly been exposed as a fraud, created for the Russian secret police by a professional propagandist who plagiarized the French satire about Napoleon III. Nevertheless, the protocols have proved themselves useful to history's monstrous figures. In Russia, the ultra-conservative Black Hundreds used them to help lay the blame for Russia's humiliation in the Russo-Japanese War, which ended in 1905, the year the protocols were published in book form, on the Jews. The protocols also figured prominently in Hitler's Mein Kampf, as they did in the worldview of the Ku Klux Klan. Today, they are constantly referred to in the Middle East. A new effort is being made to undermine the credibility of protocols. The publication of The Plot, The Secret Story of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The book is the final work of William Eisner, the illustrator and writer, who died in January 2005 at age 87, just days after completing his work. The Plot mixes comic-style dramatizations in the lives of those with roles in the protocols with quotations from actual historical documents. Its aim is to show how the protocols were produced, how they've been used, and how journalists and historians have exposed them. On a much lighter note, two historical epic films have been added to the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. They are Schindler's List, released in 1993, and the 1959 version of Ben-Hur. The two historical films were included among the 25 cinematic classics selected this year for preservation. Library of Congress James H. Billington said the works were chosen from nearly 1,000 titles nominated by the public. The final selection was done by the library staff and advisors from the National Film Preservation Board. The registry's goal is to safeguard America's film heritage for future generations. Schindler's List is Steven Spielberg's seven-time Oscar-winning Holocaust tale about a German businessman who risked his life to save over 1,000 Jews from Nazi death camps. As for Ben-Hur, this is the second to make the list. The 1926 silent version was previously enshrined. The 1959 remake starred Charlton Heston as the Jewish prince bent on revenge against his Roman friend. It's widely regarded as one of the greatest films ever made, having won a record 11 Oscars. And finally, Barbie has taken up teaching history. Mattel is getting together with Golden Books to launch the Barbie Diary of the Decade series. The first two books focus on 1964 and 1976. The 60s diary has Barbie hosting a Beatles party the first night they appear on The Ed Sullivan Show. Barbie also learns about the Civil Rights Act with her African-American friend, Christy. In the 1970s volume, Disco Barbie plans a dance and travels to Philadelphia to celebrate the bicentennial and see Rocky on the Art Museum steps. When we return, Fred Nielsen will be speaking with David Herlihy about the history of the bicycle. Sam Weinberg will comment on the preparation of history teachers, and Kelly Shrum will tell you about a site where you can learn more about one person's actual experience living as a colonist. This is Talking History. Don't do it.
les Champs-Élysées, Tour de France, Tour de France.
As you watch or read about the Tour de France this week, you historians in the audience may be interested in learning more about the history of the bicycle. Look no further. Talking History's Fred Nielsen is here to talk with David Herlihy, the author of Bicycle, the History.
According to my guest, David Herlihy, our ancestors counted the modern bicycle among their greatest achievements, ranking with the steamship, the railroad, the telegraph, and the telephone. The search for what was sometimes called a mechanical horse began 300 years ago. The bicycle appeared in something close to its modern form after the Civil War. By 1900, it was paving the way, literally, Herlihy says, for the automobile. Simple yet sophisticated, bicycles are still with us in the 21st century, more numerous than ever. The story of the bicycle is an enthralling one, a story of inventors, of gentlemen and ladies seeking recreation, of common people doing their jobs, of racers setting speed records, of kids riding their bikes. It's the one that David Herlihy tells in his new book, Bicycle, the History. Mr. Herlihy, welcome.
Thank you. Well, I'm pleased to be here.
Let's start, if not quite at the beginning, pretty early in the story. The first working version of this mechanical horse seems to go back about 200 years to the early 1800s. It's a velocipede. Human power guides it, but it doesn't have any pedals. How does this thing work?
Well, basically, you would just kick it along, and the concept that the German inventor Carl von Drais came up with was that of an aid to walking, and he reasoned that you could move faster with the machine walking along than you could without it.
Did it work?
Actually, not so well. There were certainly some conditions where you could outpace yourself compared to the walking rate, but it required basically a pretty level road. And when you think about the inconvenience of just having the machine in tow, it just didn't add up to compelling a vehicle.
We're used these days to having all sorts of rapid transportation, but I suppose it's worth noting that when the velocipede is developed, this first attempt at a mechanical horse, large numbers of people have never really gotten anywhere in their lives except on a real horse or by foot.
That's right. And I think Drais, to his credit, he was certainly addressing a very topical problem, really. And he does deserve credit for being the first to arouse a great deal of public interest in this, what had been already an ancient problem of the quest for the mechanical horse. So he certainly was an agitator, and of course, in retrospect, he wasn't all that far from a practical solution.
We associate certain people with certain inventions. Everyone knows that Alexander Graham Bell invents the telephone, Thomas Edison the light bulb. The story with the bicycle seems far more complicated. Does it have a father?
Well, I think you have to start with a definition of a basic bicycle, and I would say that the aid to walking really wasn't that, as close as it was to the first pedal-powered two-wheelers that appeared about 50 years later in the 1860s. You really need that mechanical drive, which, of course, was antithetical to what Drais was trying to do because he had come to the conclusion that mechanical drives were fruitless. When you get to that point, I think you can really, to the 1860s, talk about the basic bicycle. And it's a curious case as far as identifying an inventor because, in fact, there really isn't evidence of any convergence. I mean, logically, the idea of adding a mechanical drive, had it flown naturally out of, you know, given technology, it should have appeared around, say, 1820. So we can pretty well locate the time and place to Paris, although there's always been some controversy, though, about who there and at that time was responsible for the breakthrough.
The basic bicycle, the idea of two more or less equally sized wheels on a bike with a familiar frame, is one I think a lot of people take for granted these days. One of the most fascinating parts of your book, though, for me, was to look at all of the other ideas that were brought up eventually to be discarded. Things like the size of the wheels, the number of wheels. None of these things are predetermined. In fact, you have pictures of more dramatic innovations than that. There's one idea that employs sails, as I recall.
Yeah, that was a pretty early idea. But you're right. I mean, essentially, when the kick-propelled machine, Drais's original two-wheeler, was abandoned shortly after it was introduced, say, about 1820, problem was still there. He did whip up a considerable interest in it. He just didn't inspire any confidence that he was on the right track. So what happened was quite a few mechanics continued to work on that problem, but they went back to the idea of having a three or four wheeler with a mechanical drive. So you might say the development kind of missed an opportunity there. And because in fact those vehicles never really made a significant impact on the road. I mean, there was one gentleman in Dover, England, Willard Sawyer, who around the 1840s and 50s made these rather exquisite lightweight four-wheelers powered by a trail, but in fact he never really had a great deal of commercial success. So when the basic bicycle was introduced in Paris in the 1860s, it really was quite a sensation. For the first time, the public began to believe that maybe this wasn't a wild goose chase after all, and maybe there was something to work on. But then even developing that into what we would recognize as a modern bicycle, there were a lot of blind alleys, shall we say. I mean, it didn't proceed as smoothly as it might have.
One of the most advanced bicycles or styles of bikes in the 19th century after the Civil War is what are called the high mounts. These are bikes with enormous front wheels, some more than 50 inches. It's hard to look at them today without a smile, and yet they obviously had some advantages.
Well, they did. For one thing, it was really the simplest type of bicycle. I mean, once the bone shaker established, we call the bone shaker the 1860s machines, but obviously called that because they were very heavy and crude. I mean, talking about wooden carriage wheels and solid iron frames. And the next sort of development didn't introduce the high wheeler. The high mount was the same technology in the sense that it, too, was powered directly by pedals attached to the front hub. So there was no real change in the mechanism. There was a great deal of material improvement. So it had that advantage. It was the simplest design. And some people thought, of course, you know, the big wheel gave it a gearing advantage. And there was some fear that trying to find another solution, such as maybe some kind of drive, a chain drive, would introduce unnecessary friction and would be necessarily inefficient. So it was certainly perceived to have the value of simplicity. And in fact, it's also true that that high wheel was rather effective in coping with the poor roads of the day, because by this time, of course, it's a suspension wheel with steel spokes. So it absorbed rather effectively, coupled with a solid iron tire, the road shock. So it did have the advantages of simplicity. It was lightweight. There was no gadgets as far as chains or any other kind of transmission system, really, other than just being direct powered. So as far as some people were concerned, it really was the ultimate bicycle at the time.
And yet it's still a long way down when you're riding atop such a big wheel as this. It can't be any coincidence that the section after your book that discusses the high wheel era is entitled The Safety Era.
Oh, yes, that's the way the safety was built. And in some sense, that was considered an advantage to be so high up, because it removed you from the dirt, the dust of the road. It also kind of put you on level with horsemen, which I think they may have appreciated. Some early complaints about the new style low mount introduced in the late 1880s was that it was undignified to be that low. So, yeah, there was some thought that it was actually an advantage, a feature, shall we say, not a flaw. But, of course, in fact, it was a flaw, because if your front wheel happened to hit some object on the road, you could be catapulted right over the handlebars in what was known as the header. And so, in fact, it was a very dangerous machine.
Once it becomes safer, it's still pretty expensive. Throughout your book, there are recurring considerations of class. Cycling is at first a gentleman's activity, partly because bikes cost much more than the masses could afford. When does it become a mass phenomenon? How did the common people eventually get involved?
This is an interesting point you're raising, because, in fact, that original bicycle in the 1860s, although very pricey and very crude, it was in some sense a popular machine in that it had at least what might be considered an inviting profile. And you see an explosion of popular interest in that machine. In the United States in 1869, the craze passed from France. The New York Times marveled that there had never been such a demand for an article, and something like 20,000 were built in that short period. And rinks opened up across the country where the public was supposedly training. Of course, these first bicycles were not really all that accessible or effective, but nevertheless, there was a sense that this would evolve into the people's nag. And that was a big disappointment, really, when the bicycle, the high wheeler, really overcame a lot of the technical problems, but it also kind of moved away from that original goal. And so the whole notion of a bicycle in the 1880s pretty much changed from the idea of this could really be the practical mechanical horse to this is sort of an elitist gentleman's hobby exclusively. And so all of this gets turned upside down in the great 1890s boom, because you have the reintroduction of something that was, inviting to the general public. And even though it was still rather pricey, there was definitely a sense with automobiles looming that this was destined truly, finally, at last, to be something practical. inaccessible. And in fact, when you get to the early years of the 20th century, the price just plummets after the boom, and they are available at something like $20-$25 from department stores. And so that really does become within the reach of the average workman.
What's the bicycle's effect on women specifically?
Well, that's a very interesting question, too, because, in fact, again, there was, well, even going back to the hobby horse of 1819, Dennis Johnson, the primary maker of those machines in London, introduced a ladies' model. And you see in the bone shaker era a great deal of interest among women. But, of course, that was short-lived because once you get to the high wheel era, there were some show girls, shall we say, who rode these things, but generally it was certainly not something that a lady of the time would ride. I mean, there were eventually tricycles available. But the bicycle really has a major impact on women when you get to that boom of the 1890s, because at that point there's an enormous demand among women to ride, sometimes estimated as much as a third of the market, and we're talking millions of bicycles at this point, was destined for women. And you actually see that, too, and reflected in the colorful posters of the time. Many of them feature women. Some, I would say, are probably designed to attract the male attention, but there are certainly others that are clearly targeted to women. So, of course, this was a problem, too, generally speaking, at that point, because what women tended to wear was not terribly compatible with cycling. The long robes could get entangled and so forth. So, at the time, the bicycle was credited by many people as being the leading dress reformer. In fact, the subject of dress reform had been discussed for some time. Amelia Bloomer had introduced her Turkish pants back in the 1850s without much success, but it's thought that the bicycle of the 1890s really was a very progressive force in that regard, and maybe not even just for women. I think in some cases for men, too, it simplified what was considered acceptable garb.
Interesting thing about the bicycle, it begins almost in a pre-industrial era, a search to get a mechanical horse, as we've mentioned. But you also make an emphatic point in your book that it helps pave the way, literally, you say, for the automobile. And you also note that the Wright brothers, before they're making airplanes, are working in their bicycle shop. Paves the way to the future.
It does. And I think, in fact, it was often recognized as such. The bicycle became a symbol of modernity. Really, all along, you often see it depicted as a symbol of progress. So there was a sense that it was leading the way to a what some call the new era in road transport. So, yeah, it was a powerful idea. And it certainly, I think it's fair to say that it aroused a great demand for mobility that, in part, the bicycle itself could not answer. So there's that aspect, too, of just the preparing the way in that sense. But also, from an industrial point of view, much of the technology that was developed in the 1890s to produce millions of bicycles went straight into producing the first automobiles. And in fact, you've got a pretty good overlap between some of these early automotive pioneers and the bike business leaders. For example, Albert Pope, before Henry Ford, was the leading automobile producer in this country, and also the recognized father of the American cycle industry. So I think it had a lot to do with that. And as you mentioned, the Wright brothers, the fact that they had been trained, they were professional bike mechanics, they used that knowledge that they had acquired to build the Wright Flyer. I mean, they literally used the same parts in many instances, the chains and so forth that they had used on bicycles. So I think it helped the amateur mechanic. It really stimulated a lot of interesting ideas.
Another thing that the bicycle is good for is going faster under human power than people have ever gone before. Someone like Lance Armstrong is a household name now, of course, but I noted in your book there are several athletes, people like Arthur Zimmerman and Major Taylor, from the turn of the 20th century, who become, well, if not wealthy, at least well-paid and internationally acclaimed for their bicycle racing.
Well, racing had been popular even during the high wheel era. You had enormous annual meets, for example, in Springfield, Massachusetts. The high wheeler, though, didn't have a vast popular appeal. It was nonetheless a spectacle. I mean, races did draw the public. But when you get to the great bicycle boom, and people could really relate to the machines that racers were using, you really see an explosion in the racing world, just an enormous interest, unprecedented. And you do see the emergence of some really superstars. I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that Major Taylor was probably the first black superstar athlete. And in fact, when he competed in Paris in the the velodrome there against the French champion in 1902 thereabouts. I think it was something like 20,000 people came, and they did make good money at the time. In fact, even after the boom, the sport of cycling continued to be popular on both sides of the Atlantic. Of course, in France, you see 1903, the first Tour de France, which has always commanded an interest ever since. But even in this country, track racing remained popular up until really the Depression. You know, in the 1920s, you had quite a few velodromes, and you had people making a pretty good living from that sort of work.
You quote an observer back in the 1890s boom who said that it's impossible to calculate the far-reaching effects of the bicycle's influence. You've written a history of its development, projected into its future. What would you summarize is the influence of the bicycle?
Well, I think originally it was very much a catalyst in terms of transportation and technology. So it was state-of-the-art at the time, really. Of course, now I don't think anyone would consider the bicycle state-of-the-art, even though there's increasingly sophisticated gearing mechanisms and so forth. It's really kind of gone the other way now, where it's, shall we say, almost anti-technology in a sense. And yet it's still a very valuable resource. It's quite extraordinary to me to have just visited Cambridge, England, for example, seeing how many people are out there cycling. Everybody's cycling, and it just makes perfect sense. I mean, if you imagine all those people on bikes riding cars instead, things would be even worse than they are now. So as I see into the future, the bicycle really is, it's a great resource that's underutilized, and there may be possibilities for more technical developments, I'm sure, but the fact is it's even now a very compelling resource.
Well, Mr. Herlihy, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I've been talking with David Herlihy, the author of Bicycle, The History.
Our guest this week, Sam Weinberg, finds it outrageous that nearly a third of the students who apply to Stanford University's Master's in Teaching program to become history teachers have never taken a single college course in history. But he also finds it to be part of a well-established national pattern. Weinberg, professor of education at Stanford University, is the author of Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts, published by Temple University Press.
Imagine this. Nearly a third of the students who apply to Stanford's MA program in teaching to become history teachers have never taken a college course in history. Outrageous? I think so. But it's part of a well-established pattern. Among high school history teachers across the country, only 18% have majored or minored in the subject they now teach. I don't doubt the dedication of these people. The applications I read at Stanford shine with a commitment that renews my faith in the passion of today's youth. And nearly every one of these young people is willing to forsake more lucrative careers to pursue teaching. But how can you teach what you don't know? Would someone who wanted to teach calculus dare submit a transcript with no math courses? Yet with history, the theory goes, all you need is a big heart and a thick book. The state of California encourages this. Although it requires teachers to earn a rigorous credential before they can teach math or biology or chemistry, there is no such credential in history. Instead, California hands out a loosey-goosey social science credential. To qualify to teach history in California and in many other states, you can major in almost anything, anthropology, psychology, ethnic studies. All you've got to do is to earn the social science credential and pass a multiple-choice test of historical facts. But a storehouse of facts is the beginning, not the end of historical understanding. History courses made up of all facts and no interpretation are guaranteed to put kids to sleep. And that's exactly what seems to be happening. In a national survey some years ago, 1,500 Americans were asked to pick one word or phrase to describe their experience with history classes. The most frequent answer was boring. It should be obvious why this is so. I don't care how much you know about child psychology or cultural anthropology. when you have to teach about the Marshall Plan or the partition of India or the bombing of Hiroshima, you will be a brittle pedagogue if the only thing you know how to do is obey the textbook. History engages students when their teachers possess deep knowledge of it. When they don't, history has the vitality of sawdust. The old saying that a good teacher needs only to stay a chapter ahead of students is widely believed but patently false. History is about how events in one age sow the seeds for what happens next. Good teachers foreshadow later lessons when teaching earlier ones by helping students see, for example, that the configuration of power left in the wake of World War II would eventually erupt as the Korean War. History is just a random mess to those who stay a chapter ahead. We are in an age where states are one-upping each other to beef up standards for students. But how can we expect history students to attain high standards when we set the bar so low for teachers?
You've been listening to Sam Weinberg, professor of education at Stanford University and the author of Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts. This is Talking History. And finally, as a compliment to Sam Weinberg's commentary on the teaching of history, Kelly Schramm of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University tells us about a website where you can learn more about everyday life in early America through the experiences of one modern woman's life as a New England colonist.
17-year-old Amy Wires describes her experience living as a New England colonist. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed being away from modern-day technology. I expected to really miss TV and radio, but once I returned home, I realized that not only had I not missed them, but I had never really even thought about them. A companion to the series Frontier House, this site documents the 5 months that 26 American volunteers spent in the Maine wilderness recreating life in 1628 New England. The site provides short biographies of all 26 participants, a behind-the-scenes look at the making of the show, and a series of short activities designed to highlight colonial American history. An online scavenger hunt allows students to learn about day-to-day colonial life. The site includes 14 video clips, 12 audio clips, and more than 90 photographs of the cast and village. The Myth Conceptions Quiz and the Language Tutorial allow you to test your knowledge of colonial America and compare 17th century English to 20th century English. Although there are a few historical resources, including excerpts from colonial era diaries and a sample of colonial laws and regulations, visitors will not find document collections or historical maps. The site's primary value is in the anecdotes that reveal information about daily life in 17th century New England. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu. Type Colonial House into the keyword search.
And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. But before we close, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beatty, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.